Leave them on the chairs over there. Somebody will come. Om Asato Ma Sandagamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Mritangamaya Aviravirmoedi Rindrayate Dakshinam Muham Te Namam Pahinityam. Lead us from the unreal to the real. Lead us from darkness unto light. Lead us from death to immortality. Reach us through and through ourselves, and evermore protect us from ignorance by thy sweet, compassionate face. Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhetamastu, Ma Vindvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. May the Divine Being
look over us, loving Jesus, Mother and Father.
May the Divine Being support and nourish us as a Mother and Father. May we have the strength and skill
to study together
the art of spirituality. May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om Peace, Peace. Peace be unto us all. This is one of the series called Sages of the West. I feel I need to do a little bit of justification this morning. Ordinarily, our discourses here, as you know, are about either philosophical and spiritual topics, and many of them derived from India, or about great holy personalities that we all know and revere or should know. Today's is different. This person of whom I'm going to talk to you today, I don't think any of you have even heard of. His name was Bernard Palissy, a Frenchman. And I want to say, by way of preface or introduction, all knowledge is considered by the sages of India as sacred. All knowledge is sacred. Just the fact that man can know is a miracle when you look at the other animals and the earth. And I remember clearly when I once laid some books on the floor in New York, and I was told that, I said, it's just a dictionary. Dictionary is worse, it contains all the words. The Swami was upset. We consider the floor as the dirtiest part of our environment, perhaps, indoors. And our shoes go there and so on. You don't put books, not just holy books, any kind of books, on the floor. I had to learn this because, and I understood that it meant all knowledge is to be revered. Well, when I see the misappropriation of knowledge everywhere in the world around me, its political misapplication, all its other kinds of applications, which I think are inappropriate, I have to bring myself back to think about what is the value of knowledge, true knowledge, the pursuit of knowledge. You know, Swami Vivekananda once said, "The great superstition of India is," I've quoted this before, "the great superstition of the Indian people is that that is sacred only which is produced from caves and forests and is connected to the transcendental and the mysterious and the mystical and so on. And India does not care for that particular kind of knowledge which manifests itself in the laboratory, the scientific experiment, in down the microscope, the telescope. Many wonderful people have dedicated their whole lives to the pursuit of truth in other than mystical ways. And that's what we're going to talk about this morning in the case of Bernard Palissy. He lived, well, let me go, before I get started into his life, let me go on a little bit more. Here is a quotation that I would like to read to you. In answering the question, why did I take up the series of Western sages at all? I've quoted Swamiji to you. The history of science is full of stories illustrating the queer limitations of genius and the frequent inability of scientists to understand one another, even when they stand closest. And I would say the same thing can be said of spiritual heroes. And our purpose in Vedanta, our understanding of Vedanta, is how to bring together not only diverse and culturally separate spiritual heroes and concepts, but also how to bring the spiritual ones into sync, into harmony with those of the secular world. And I believe, and I think you believe too, that the pursuit of truth, wherever it is found, is a sacred pursuit. A pursuit of truth for its own sake, at the expense of one's own life and health and well-being, at the expense of one's pocketbook and one's political future and so on. All of these things are sacrifices which are made by people who want truth and look for truth in whatever field of human endeavor they pursue. This is my point. This is what I want to put across this morning. That this kind of knowledge we're going to study today is, in its own way, as pioneering as the pursuits of the sages in the days of the Upanishads, in the forests and in the caves. It's in a different framework. Now, the question arises, is this humanism? Because the fundamentalists and many other kinds of religious people will point the finger at us accusingly and say, well, you're a humanist. You don't believe that God has anything to do with the revelation of truth. You don't go to the scriptures. You believe man has the capacity to develop his own scientific scriptures. and you worship Darwin, and you worship Freud, and you worship Kuti, and so on and so forth. This is called humanism, and it has very popular following in many countries, not so much in America. We are churchgoers. But in countries where the church has less influence than it has in our country, there are many, many people who call themselves humanists. Now I want to make a distinction. Are we, as Vedantists, following what I'm talking about this morning, are we humanists? No, because as I understand the ordinary formulation of humanism, it says man is complete in himself as he stands. Man as he is in his own spiritually ignorant, unenlightened state is the tops. There isn't anything that you have to ask for or look for beyond man in his wonderful intellectual capacity to probe and experiment and to discover the secrets of the universe. The whole universe lies in front of him, and he is the master of his destiny, he is the captain of his soul. He can go, if he has a soul, he can go and explore all this, these mysteries and see what greatness there is in man. Yes, yes, there is greatness in man. Vedanta says that greatness has a universal, infinite, absolute, divine origin. Man is great because he is divine. Man's greatness is immensely enhanced by the discovery of his own divinity. And if the discoveries that man makes, wonderful as they may be, do not extend to the discovery of his own inner being and his divine origin and goal, then that greatness is no greatness. It's not real greatness. So we do not consider ourselves humanists. That's much too limiting. Man, as he is, it doesn't really need a savior. That's right. But man, until he discovers the outer and inner dimensions, if there are any, of his being, is as good as in need of a savior. So, having given that preamble, I am ready to talk about our sage of the day. Bernard Palissy was, like Leonardo da Vinci, no scholar. He was a peasant. He was born in a poor peasant family in about 1510. There's no record of his birth. Nobody knows exactly when he was born. But about 1510, he was born in a western part of France called Saintonge. I don't know exactly where that is. I'm going to look it up in the Atlas pretty soon. I forgot to do it before I came. But it's in the western side, on the western side of France, in the countryside. He had no knowledge of Latin. And you see, that immediately sets him apart from the other people, who the other people of the sapience of that day. All the scholars, all the academic people, all the people who were appointed to academies and universities were people who knew Latin. You weren't anybody unless you had studied Latin in those days. So he was a nobody. He took up his profession from early boyhood as a vitrier. Now, a vitrier is a person, I didn't know this, a person who makes the colored glass for stained glass windows in churches and cathedrals. That's what he was trained in from childhood, and that was his profession for some years. Now, what happened was that churches no longer could afford. Great cathedrals were not being built much after that. They'd been built already. And no new churches were able to afford and asking for stained glass windows. So he had to change his profession. But before he did that, he made what is called the Tour de France. And the Tour de France is what you did when you were a young man in order to find out what kind of environment you live in. Just as you, we don't do it here so much, but you know, there was a generation that did that. You get on a bicycle, you get on a motorcycle, you get on your feet, and you go around the country, around to discover the different parts of the country, what they're made of and who they are. So he went all around France, he went to the different provinces in the south and the north, covered the whole country, seeing the people, trying to understand their culture, their dialects, and so on. That's what he did in the Tour de France. He saw the farmers of France, and he glorified them. Now, this was an absolutely new departure. Nobody who was talking or teaching or thinking in France in those days glorified farmers. They didn't even have the status that farmers have in this country today. No. They were considered the dumb oxes, the uneducated, the outcasts, so to speak. And nobody really cared about what the farmers did, although the vast majority of the people of the country were farmers and supporting the economy of the country. So he came back and talked a lot about farmers and what they did and how they preserved the land and what mistakes they were making. Well, he married and raised a good-sized family, and he had to turn to pottery and surveying in order to make a living. He turned from the glass to pottery, and he made all kinds of pots, and he had very special enamels that he developed. He developed a very special white enamel, which was superb in its kind. He didn't use a wheel. I don't know much about pottery. Maybe I wish Carol were here. But I don't know how pottery is done without a wheel. But what it tells me is that he had large plates. He used large plates instead of a wheel, on which he did his pottery. And he developed enamels which were extraordinary and caught the attention of a very important duke, duke of the Lord Montmorency was his name, and a nobleman who decided to patronize him, and from that to be a patron of his, I should say, rather. And that was what set him on the path of rising up, enabled him to raise his status. Well, and the next thing that happened was that he was through that Lord Montmorency, he was introduced to Saint Bernard. Saint Bernard, one of the great saints of France, living at that time with a great reputation. And Saint Bernard took him as seriously, and he wrote to him and asked him how he could live his life, how he should live his life. And Bernard wrote him a nice letter back, telling him, "You are married. You are living in the world. You should try your best to live an ideal householder's life." Montmorency brought one of his pots, one of his enamel creations, to the attention of the Queen Mother. And the Queen Mother became his patron. And from then on, everything was quite easy for him financially. Queen Mother bought his pots, and she was very careful to see that the ones she liked best were preserved. And then came the Protestant uprising, and the Catholic Church banned all kinds of Protestant creations, including pots. made by Protestants, and all of the works and all of the kilns and the studio of the potters who were Protestants were all destroyed. And the Queen Mother, I almost said Holy Mother, the Queen Mother said, don't destroy the pots of Monsieur Palissy. I like his enamels and I want them continued to be made. So he saved his neck by having the Queen Mother as a patron. I should mention that before that, Palissy saw the heretics being burned alive. You remember Bruno, and he saw cases like this and other evils connected to the church. Of course, he'd been brought up in the Catholic Church. Having seen all of that, he had turned away from it and had become a Calvinist. And as a Calvinist, he was pursued and persecuted and criticized and so on. But even though his kilns and workshops were destroyed, he still had the favor of the noblemen and the queen. And when he was thrown in prison for being a Calvinist, Montmorency got him out. And one of the things that he did after he got out of prison was to combine the environment with ceramic creations. I wonder if any of you have been to the Atlanta Botanical Garden recently.
Yes.
What do you call that? What was that word?
Chihuly.
Chihuly?
Yeah.
He was a Chihuly before Chihuly. He made glass and ceramic things and put them into gardens.
That's extraordinary.
And made the aesthetic combination of that kind and had them on exhibit, just as this man. I wonder if this man even knows of Palissy. I doubt it. Well, came the what's called the Saint Bartholomew Massacre. You know the Saint Bartholomew Massacre? The massacre of how many thousands of Protestants? When the massacre came. In 1572, when he was a mature operating ceramicist, this massacre came, and again, Palissy was saved by the Queen Mother. Her name, Catherine de' Medici. Catherine de' Medici saved him. Such was her appreciation for artistic and beautiful things and for the contributions of people of different parts of the country and different countries. She was a person of considerable taste in spite of all that we hear about the Medicis. Palissy was in her service for 25 years doing whatever she wanted done in the artistic way, and in particularly in making what they used so many of in those days, pots. Pots they used for every kind of thing, and he would make very special kinds of pots. Well, all this time, Palissy was writing his book. His book, Scivias, is just chock full of facts. And what you have to understand about the novelty of this man is that while the savants at the universities and the academies were writing about theories, things which they thought they could learn from having their hands clean and reading books. Palissy was writing about from hands-on knowledge. He worked in the soil. He investigated the brooks and the streams, and he watched the heavens, and he observed. And what he wrote in his book is about facts, chock full of facts, about agriculture, about geology, minerals, chemistry, theology, ventured into theology and defended his Protestantism. And from that book you can find what some of the pioneering adventures were for Palissy. He was the first to announce that rain and snow come from springs and rivers. Just imagine that. Now, I mean, in the West, I don't say that this wasn't known in Eastern countries long before. It must have been. But the first in the Western world of knowledge, the first to declare that rain and snow are derived from the rivers and the springs, that the water cycle is complete in this way. He was the first to recognize what fossils are. He would bring them to his students and explain how wood had petrified, how fossils had formed from animals that had died and been isolated. So, in other words, he was an ancestor of the science of paleontology. One of his famous quotations, "The earth is never idle." The earth is never idle. All kinds of things are going on in it that you wouldn't dream of. He denounced alchemy, and in that he was very, not much a pioneer, because alchemy was had sway in that day. Alchemy was the one of the popular fads of the day. Many of the people who were in the scientific world, supposed to be in the scientific world, and who were teaching classes and giving lectures and so on, still believed in alchemy. There were many pseudo-chemists who were trying to transmute metals. He declared unequivocally that metals cannot be transmuted, and he never spared alchemy from his criticisms and denunciations. He made a thorough study of salts, of clays, of chemical compounds. He made 300 ceramic experiments alone. He loved the soil as only a peasant can, and he went around and preached to the farmers that they were wasting their manure, that they were letting it wash away, even though they used some, they didn't use it properly. And he would teach them or tell them about animal husbandry and the things that he had learned about the soil and how to handle it, how to manage it. He saw the mistakes that the farmers were making, and the woodworkers woodsmen who were cutting the trees. He deplored the way in which trees were cut down and wasted. He was one of the earliest environmentalists who tried to prevent trees from being simply used as scrap and wastefully. He made two remarkable declarations. One of them, I think, is very applicable, appropriate for us. He said, you know, first of all, let me say that from the time of the Greeks, early Greek thinkers, right up through the Romans and the early Christians and Semitic Jewish scholars and thinkers, there has been the assumption, the dogma, if you like, of four elements: earth, fire, water, and air. Palissy said, I don't care how many of the learned professors declare that there are four elements. I know that there is a fifth element without which none of the other four could exist. That's Sankhya. That is pure Sankhya philosophy. Akasha has to precede these four elements in creation. And nobody else that I know of in the whole of the Western world had said that before.
Aristotle did, I think.
What?
Aristotle.
He did?
He did. And that's how the word quintessence came. Before that, there were only four elements.
Oh.
And he added the fifth one.
But he came after.
That's true.
He came after Palissy.
Okay, that's fine.
Aristotle.
Yeah.
300 B.C.
Oh, Aristotle. I'm not thinking of Aristotle. Who was I thinking of? Aquinas I was thinking of.
Aristotle,
I'm sorry. Yeah, but that didn't pertain. If he said that, it didn't take hold.
I'm not specifically sure on that, but that's how the word quintessence was derived from that point on, from four to five.
Well, what was the fifth element called?
I think it was called either ether, sky, or something like that, which exactly tallies with our Sankhya philosophy. I have a vague memory, but that's what I remember.
Well, now that's strange, because my information said that in the time of Palissy, all of the professors or the schools, the colleges and universities, were describing as four elements. I'll have to look it up. I'll have to look into it. So I may be wrong that he was about the first on that. But I think in the time when he was living, in the Middle Ages, the four-element theory was the one prevalent. Do you know?
That's an interesting point, though.
Yeah. He maximized the role of water and neglected the role of fire. Well, some people, you know, take to one element, some take to another. So he maximized the role of water throughout all of his suppositions and his propositions and his conceptions. He kept a list. In 1975, Palissy decided to take the material from his book and give public lectures. And so in Paris, here was a man without any knowledge of Latin, without any proper academic education, giving lectures to the public and on subjects of erudite discovery and knowledge. He talked naturalism from hands-on experience and not from the theories in the colleges. He had an audience of about 40 people at each lecture in the heart of Paris and charged a very small amount for each lecture. And he compared what he knew to the naturalism that was propounded in the academies. He held up fossils and explained them. I always said that. He held up fossils and explained them to his students and explained what they were, and became, I would liken him to a figure like John Dobson, perhaps? Somebody who has only a basic education, not a PhD, and who from first-hand experience and observation can tell you quite a lot more than sometimes the astronomers can. He also, you might liken him to Gerald Hurd in the scope of the subjects that he could talk about and the kinds of things he had special erudite information on. He lectured in Paris to this group of people. Who were they? Who came? Doctors, businessmen, middle-class people, bankers, and people who were just curious, the people who were probably a lot of oddballs, you call them, came around. And he would talk to these people. And all of this was recorded in his book. He did it for 10 years. He talked to this group of listeners for 10 years. And his addresses were about water and fountains, the folly of alchemy, gold as medicine, ice, the nature of ice, you know, water expanding and shrinking at the freezing point, all that. Salts, all kinds of salts. Now, this is all before there was a periodic table or any knowledge of how salts, how elements combine, you know. And he, practical knowledge of salts. The origin and growth of minerals. How to extract salt from salt marshes. Preceding Gandhi. precious and common stones and precious stones, the nature of them, how they form. Earthenware, enamel, marl. All of those kinds of things he brought out, and he brought them out in the form of lectures, which were, from our standpoint, they'd be quite learned lectures. You have to read them in French, and they are quite wordy and technical in a way. And yet, here it is, all from his own experience. Well, he called his lectures a dialogue between book learning and experience. And he put it in that form. The way he gave the lecture was in this form. Doctor, learned professor speaks, and then somebody gave him some name which represented Palissy, speaks. And the dialogue goes on like this. The learned professor gives his views and his theories about all the things in nature, and then Palissy comes back and shows how mistaken he is about from personal experience. And that's the way it goes. Well, what kind of a person was he? And here are some of the things that we know. He was actively kind. Made a point to see that people in indigent families were given whatever he could give them. He never took money for himself. Whatever protection he took from the Queen, or from Montmorency, was just what he needed and no more. Support his family. And he was pious. He was a good, pious Calvinist. Not that I like that so much, but anyway, he was a good, pious Calvinist. And generous, tolerant of difference of opinion, tolerant of all kinds of persuasions. He was prudent. You can imagine that, prudent. Quiet, unaggressive in his propounding of his views unlike Bruno. You know? Mm-hmm. Bruno, so aggressive, so adamant, so fiery, constantly in your face. Bruno was always in your face. This man was not like that. He loved his fellow human beings. And we have to say that his works, he wrote two or three books. They're compendiums of information that never been known before. And his works were unique examples of pre-scientific literature. If we have to call that era the era of pre-science, or a pre-scientific era, then his literature were unique examples of it. Actually, the lack of the knowledge of Latin was a help to him, because it made him express in French, in his native language, what had never been expressed in it before. He has been called a creator of the French language, because having to use his native tongue, and he created words, new words, he made a new vocabulary in science, and he made new connections in science that were not possible before in French. When you consider that he lived in a perfectly miserable time, Palissy lived in the time of holy wars, persecutions, Inquisition, the Reformation, the Renaissance, not the Renaissance, Reformation, and the Counter-Reformation. He lived in the 16th century, which was an awful, awful time to be living. And all of that miasm of violence and contention and unsettled politics and lifestyle, he managed to do all of this, which I think is quite a miracle. I'm going to read to you what he wrote in the preface to his book. Beginning of his book, he addresses the reader. Friend reader, since it has pleased God to have this writing fall into your hands. This is a nice way to write it, start a book. Since it has pleased God to have this writing fall into your hands, I beg of you not to read only part of it, but after getting some benefit, take care to read it all. Forgiving the crude and unadorned language, you will find much to your profit, and things unbelievable at the beginning, you will find eventually easy to believe. Above all, recall the passage in Holy Scripture where St. Paul says, all perfect, good and perfect gifts cometh from above. That's, I think, Corinthians 12. All good and perfect gifts cometh from the God above. Remember then that this passage, that all these are gifts of God. And then I beg of you to teach the illiterate laborers to study carefully, all the illiterate laborers to study carefully the laws of nature. Great Democrat, a great democratizing influence, determined that the common man should have the benefits of all of this. Well, the church nabbed him in the end. I'm sorry to say. The church nabbed him. He was thrown again into prison. Lived in prison for many years until he got quite sick. And I suppose he had some kind of friends and company during that time. But he died in prison, and his body was thrown over the wall to be eaten by dogs.
Queen didn't have
another martyr.
The queen. The queen did not.
She had died by that time. Yeah. Palissy was not ostensibly a mystic. I tried to find some elements of mysticism in his writing, but apparently he was not inclined that way, and that's why I made some justification in the beginning for bringing him in. I think this will be the final of the series of Sages of the West, because we've reached the 16th century, 17th century, really. And I was interested in those who had still got roots in the time when East and West had been less distinctive, just separate, and when many things had passed from the East to the West. We looked at Cusa, Nicholas of Cusa. We looked at Sir Thomas More, the great British martyr. We briefly discussed Copernicus and Galileo, and went on to Bruno in detail. And now Palissy, I would call him the last of the great, quote, humanistic, in quotes, sages who were sages of science, sages who gave their lives to truth and to their fellow human beings and to their country and to the world, practically unknown. Most of these are not on our tongues today. We don't credit them the way we do Aristotle and the others.
This name, how did you get to it?
I'm sorry, but I have only one book that I have I can give to you. I got it all out of one book in English. Everything else is in French. Everything else is in French. You cannot.
That's how you learned about his name and his works?
Mm-hmm. Then I went to... I can read French, fortunately, but it's just not available. He's not even on the web. I don't think he's on the web, last time I looked. I don't really have anything more to say, and I thought we would probably run out of material before the time was up, and that's what we've done. We didn't take up Da Vinci because he's so well known that the one figure, non-academic, who was not an academic and not a scholar and didn't approach truth that way, but whose talent and whose productivity is so well known, his creativity so much studied and so much acquainted with, we are. That I didn't want to take time to go over again material which most of you know about Leonardo and his immensely versatile contribution to culture and civilization. So if you have any questions, I will try to answer them from what little I know about Palissy. Bernard the Seg has never heard of him. A Frenchman. He couldn't be here today, but he's going to hear the lecture on tape. And in fact, he didn't. I had to get him to translate some of the old French that I wanted to have here.
Samiji, this may be a very elementary question, but how would you qualify him to be included in the sage category?
Have I not given that?
Yeah, but you know, other qualifications like.
If you didn't get that point, then I don't know how to do it.
No, I did. It's an inquisitive mind.
Oh, you mean you want a rationalization for it?
A little bit, yeah.
But I gave that in the very beginning, Uma. I said that all knowledge is sacred. Do you insist that everyone must be religious?
Not that way, but any other than opening up the democratic way of looking at things, and he definitely wrote in French instead of Latin and used all that.
Yeah.
So that makes him, whatever you said, that he was a democratic one and looking at things from scientific, from hand-on experience and all that. But the depth of experience that we look in a mystic or that kind I'm looking for in anything more.
But I've already said that I didn't find that in him. I got it, I announced it in the bulletin, all right? Once you announce it in the bulletin, you have to go ahead and speak on that. I have no justification except that I announced his name in advance, and I had thought that I would find more of religion in his life. You see, one thing you must understand. We, in our time of history, we think of religious people as people who go to temples or churches or read a Bible or Quran or Gita, who are basically pious, well-behaved, and virtuous, moral, and so on. We tend to think of those as religious people in our day because religion has fallen into such a low form of practice. In those days, as I understand it, in those days of Palissy, a Catholic family like his would be brought up observing throughout the entire day sacraments, small acts of worship, of prayer, of carrying out the mass, going to the mass, and going every day to church. You see, every day to mass in the church. That's what kind of a family he would be growing up in. Now, a person writing about his life will not be able to tell you what kind of piety he had, how deeply he loved God, or how deeply. My measurement, my ruler for judging the character of this person is how his life demonstrated how much he loved man and how much he loved God. And then when he became a Protestant, obviously it was absolutely against his well-being. To become a Protestant then, at that time, was the worst thing he could have done for his future. And then, but he did it on conviction. Here is a man who did it on conviction. He must have had good thinking and reasoning about theology in order to be able to do that. And he was able to discern what in religion is valuable and what is phony. And he made his choice. That man is a sage. What more do I need to say?
That peach.
All right, you brought it out of me. You brought it out of me.
Yeah. So there are two or three things, comment-wise, which passed my mind. Number one, whatever obsession those people had with the Latin, in India, the people had the same obsession with Sanskrit. Mm-hmm. That if you do not know Sanskrit, no matter how scholarly you are, you will not be considered a scholar.
That's right.
But and at the same time, farmers, there have been many sage farmers in India. So somehow there is something to do with the farming. Either farming was a very common thing, you know, in the human beings there, or the very experience of tilling and see the things sprouting, you know, motivates them to think of higher source. But those kind of farmer sages have been very well accepted. The difference is not one of them has been killed by anybody.
Not one of them been killed.
Just killed by anyone. No, they have been accepted, respected, and until the last point, they have been treated like sages.
Well, that's the difference between the East and the West.
That's what I'm saying.
But, you know, I was born over here. And because I was born over here, I have to dig in and find all the jewels and gems that I can find in my own culture. That's what I did. That's why we had the series on Sages of the West. I wanted to find those gems and jewels and treasures which were in our own history, which we ourselves do not know. We ourselves have ignored or buried. And we're going to come in the Christian writings class. We're going to come to Meister Eckhart, and that will be the crowning blow of the crown of everything from there. So that's the justification, and it's almost 12.
We enormously appreciate that, Swami. Enormously, because nobody else can unlock these heroes.
Swami, well, I have an observation. If we accept that mystical experience really is consciousness in which you realize that there is something larger than your little self, and then you commune with it. If we accept that definition, I would say Bernard Palissy was a mystic, according to that definition. Mm-hmm. So
I
mystical
think.
Experience is not necessarily a religious.
Well, of course, I feel that way, but I would, for your sake, you know.
I mean, even people who go to a concert and lose themselves in the music probably have a mystical experience maybe for that particular time.
That's the way we define, that is the broadest possible definition of mysticism. Actually, religious might have been a better thing to say. He was not. You can't show that he was a deeply. You can't. I can. Yeah, he was not a church person.
Yeah, right.
That's okay.
Not only he wasn't a church person, he wasn't a monk. He wasn't any ostensible or pretentious way a conveyor of religion, as such.
Like Bhagir is saying, farmers are always aware of the fact that there is something larger than that.
Right. Well, it has been a fascinating experience for me giving this series, and I'm sorry the earlier ones weren't recorded. But anyway,
some were recorded, but Bruno was recorded.
Was it?
Yes.
I don't remember. Anyway. Thank you all for bearing with it, whether you were really interested or not. And forgive my mistakes. We've got to find out about this five element, because he felt that he was saying something brand new. I mean, I don't know why.
He hadn't studied Latin.
He hadn't studied Latin, yes.
That's probably where the Greek...
he didn't study Greek either.
Yeah, so he may not have had the benefit of...
Linguistic.
He may have been picking up the four elements from the common parlance.
Yeah.
You know, Swamiji, apart from anything else, for example, in medical literature, over the last 10, 15 years, a rule has been made that any publication or any statement which says that this is the first time this has been reported should immediately be discarded.
Yeah.
Say that within the existing knowledge, no other has done
that. Nobody wants to give anybody credit for being a discoverer.
You discover what is there.
Yes.
And it was there. Whether he was trained in it or consciously knew it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's the origin of this knowledge.
He unuttered it.
And if the origin is out of himself, if he's the author of this, then... it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who comes first. It matters
it takes a special person to bring it to the level of the people. You know, whatever it is that people can enjoy and understand, ordinary people. That it also is enough.
Well, there are a couple of announcements here. One is that. I already announced. Well, yes, one is that I have maps here, in case you didn't get one, to the 4th of July celebration. Tom Pouch's house, nice little map, not very far away.
I hope everyone comes.
Yeah, I hope everyone comes. He's inviting us all. Yes, there are lots of surprises in the 4th of July celebration. Always lots of surprises. And one of the surprises is that I think you will be bemused. That's the word. Bemused by the visiting Swami. He's a very special character. I know that I mentioned this before to some of you. He has a very special personality. And you may have to forgive him for something, but he is a wise man and a very dear friend, and he himself wished to come and visit us. So that is enough said about that.
Will there be other entertainment?
Mm-hmm.
Will there be music?
Mm-hmm. I say there's a lot of surprises in Fourth of July.
Will you celebrate the independence of the United States as well as Vivekananda?
Well, this year.
You didn't last year.
I didn't last year. No.
No mention at all of the independence of this country.
Well, we'll have something this year, but not a whole lot, considering the state in which the country is right now.
That's what was so noticeable last year from past years was because of the political climate.
Yeah.
It's tough.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough. Well, we'll see. And then any more questions? Let's have our benediction then. Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace. Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being.
Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being.
Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om, peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere. That means, you know, there is no meeting here on Sunday morning. Though it's a Sunday, we'll not have any service here. We'll go straight to the picnic and program.
It's at 1 o'clock.
1 o'clock.
It's in the bulletin, but it's at 1 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And Swami, could you have someone bring some chairs over to?
Oh yes.
Oh, we don't.
We'll bring our 10. We have 10.
If you will.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anybody who has a chair that can bring some, bring a chair.
Anything else, Tom?
Well, it's a puja. So, I mean, everyone.
No, it's not a puja.
I mean, it's
potluck.
Yeah. No. Apart from that, I mean, I've been.
I don't think so.
Bring a friend.
Yeah, bring a friend.
Tom, in India, it is we call paid puja.
Yeah.
So yes, it is puja.
Oh, there are some people whose pet doesn't need to be worshipped anymore.
Exactly.
Oh, gosh. Anybody want to pick it up here?
Hey, Tom.
Jim's going to be there.